So good evening. Tonight, we are going to talk about the second half of this exploration into the second noble truth, the actual desires, the three desires that are connected to this craving and attachment that we talked about last week, this kind of hunger that we talked about, thirsting after, or this insatiable longing. And we're going to talk about those desires. But I hope we can remember that, you know, when we talked about these, you know, actually we talked about it 2 weeks, but when we talked about it and looked at it, this thing that Ajahn Sumedho said in this book that I'm going to quote from at the end, he was pointing to this notion that we don't want to actually get rid of that tanha, that craving. We don't want to somehow or another make that hunger go away. And to remember that when we're talking about these desires, because inherent in this tanha, I think, is the point of this second noble truth. It's this getting up close and personal with desire. I think that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi was pointing to in the quote, that somehow or another, we're going to talk a little bit about there's kind of like a rub here, because there's desire all around us, and then there is this craving connected to desire that we're practicing around. And so trying to look at both of those two things means inherently that we have to get up close and personal with what this whole thing is with desire. And it's not up close and personal with Tuareg's opinion about what desire is. It's up close and personal with your own opinion or your own exploration of what desire is. So we're just going to see if tonight we can talk about some framework, some structure, how we could look at that. And I thought I could look at it from four teachers, maybe to put a little frame around it, because the desires themselves, that we talk about them, three of them, sensual pleasures, becoming and not becoming, or, you know, getting rid of, those are relatively simple. I mean, those, I can explain that in about 10 minutes and then we can all go home. It's not so much the desire. There's something else that this truth is pointing to that I hope we can look at when we're looking at these desires. So Gil Fronstall, he's a senior teacher down in California, in the San Francisco area. He has a retreat center in Santa Cruz. And he says that desire is so inherent to the human condition that life without it is inconceivable. It's inconceivable not to have desire. So he says it's more accurate to call us human desirelings rather than human beings. We're human desirelings. I just think that's such a cute word. And if anybody's ever seen Gil Fronstall, I met him the first time at this retreat that we did from the teacher training. And it just seems so perfect that he would call us human desirelings. But it's inherent in our human condition. And then Joseph Goldstein said in his book Mindfulness that in Buddha's quest for enlightenment, one of the first questions he asked himself, so he's asking this question to himself, what is the gratification of the world? And as he practiced with this question, it came to him that pleasure and joy is the gratification of the world. If there was no gratification, humans would not be so enamored by the world. So it is precisely the world, it's precisely because the world is full of gratification that we desire and crave pleasure. It's inherent within our living that this is going to arise. And then Arena Wiseman, in her book, Beginning Meditation, she said, because desire can never be satisfied, it is through desire that we are caught. So it's sort of like we get caught because of desire, and desire is inherently a part of our human condition. It's not going anywhere. It's always going to sort of be there. So then one more quote. Bhikkhu Bodhi said that a teaching leading to the end of suffering must give a reliable account of its cause origination. So any teaching that's going to lead to the end of suffering has to have some reliable sourcing as to where it comes from. For if we want to put a stop to suffering, we have to stop it where it begins, with its causes. And to stop the causes requires a thorough knowledge of what they are and how they work. That is the point. Those four frameworks, to me, is the point of working in the Second Noble Truth and why it's important to keep the Second Noble Truth in its function, to look at the causes of suffering. So you could even make it a little quicker and say that desire is inherent in the human condition. That's on one wall. And because the world is full of pleasure and joy, humans will forever seek their gratification through desire. That's the other wall. That desire can never be satisfied, so even though we're seeking it, it's not working. It's on top. But investigating desire is the only reliable way to understand suffering. Not to get rid of suffering, but to understand this dukkha that Tim talked about so well in the first month of January. We'll have to spend some time with desire over the course of our lives to begin to understand how that dukkha exists. And the more we understand it, the more the third and fourth noble truths will make sense. But to skip over this truth, at the second noble truth, as somehow, oh, I just have to get rid of the craving. So in some moment in time, I'm just going to let it go. Just let it go, let it go, let it go. And that's going to end it, but it doesn't. So let's talk a little bit about this first desire, is sensual pleasure. It's so basic. We have a body that feels pleasure. There's no question that the body feels pleasure. We have a mind that judges pleasure and what is agreeable, comfortable, nice, enjoyable. And it knows the opposite of that. So this tanha, this hunger, this craving in pleasure, sensual pleasure, is the wanting of pleasure through the body and other senses. Some teachers have said it's the talking, it's also talked about as always seeking some kind of excitement or pleasure. And then third way is expecting experiences to be pleasant and agreeable. That totally makes sense to me, because I can't imagine sitting expecting for something to be unpleasant, unagreeable. Right? So here we are going to talk about a practice where on one hand we are practicing with the suffering, and nobody wants that suffering to be there. We all want it to be nice and good, but the practice is directed at the suffering. So somehow, if we're not going to ask for the suffering, if we're not going to wish it to come our way, how in the world could we practice with something that everybody is running the opposite direction from? Everybody's running away from suffering, and yet that is the fundamental purpose of this truth, is to practice there at that arising suffering. And I think it's because, by the very nature of our running away from suffering, it's chasing along behind us. It's coming right on after us, and it hasn't gone anywhere. It's sort of like watching dogs chase their tail. It's not going anywhere. It's not changing anything. They're not getting away from anything. So that notion of running away from suffering, that in and of itself is where the difficulty lies. Or I guess it would be more of our, what Bhikkhu Bodhi calls the distortion of the mind, the screen that the mind puts up. And the way the mind puts up the screen, and how ignorance and the screen kind of comes into play, is when we have some sensual pleasure or we have some desire that shows up randomly. I'm going to use an example. This is when I thought of, try to think about what's the biggest, toughest desire I've ever really come up on that's really been a thorn in my side for years, and it's television. Oh. So I think it's because my parents would not let us watch TV, and everybody around me at school saw all these TV shows that my father was very rigid about what TV we could watch and what we couldn't, and he had all these ridiculous rules on the watching of TV. And by the time I got old enough to get my own TV, I was hooked. I was like enamored. And so I would watch TV, and not just watch TV a little bit. I would watch TV all night, fall asleep, and TV's on. Wake up, turn the TV on. I mean, it's just constant. I think I saw, I might be dating myself, but there was a time when TV did not run 24 hours a day. So some of us know that you would go to sleep basically because the TV turned off. There was nothing else on. Otherwise, we'd still be up watching it. That's the problem we have right now, is because we can keep watching TV. So I would watch it and watch it and watch it. And in my younger years, it was kind of like, it's okay. You know, you can watch TV. And when you're younger, you stay up late. I mean, the world is very different. But by the time I got into law school and going in towards the becoming a trial lawyer, watching TV became a big problem because I couldn't stop. I couldn't not watch it. It's like the more pressure I had on my life, the more television became the avenue to get away from that pressure. And the more I would seek an escape from this pressure by watching television. It doesn't really seem like a big deal. If you just think about, oh, I just want to watch TV for a little while, doesn't really have an edge to it. And this is why I think we have to begin to look at some of these sensual desires that we have in our lives and how we're leaning into them to escape something else. Because what would actually happen is that I would watch TV. I'm going to take this thing because I keep hearing this thing hit it. I would watch TV. I'd have some case coming up, and I'm scared of it, I'm nervous, and I would get home, and I really should prepare and pay attention and read read some of the statements, read, get prepared for this case, this trial that's coming up, or some exam that was coming up in law school. But because I would get so scared, I just couldn't do it, and I would seek something that was gonna make things a little bit better. So I'm just gonna watch a show or two, especially Law and Order. But this happens to be the Law and Order marathon weekend. So one show turns into another show, turns into another show and another show, and you're just watching. It's not like I didn't know I was watching. I know that. But every time I would think about not watching, this unpleasant panic about not knowing what to do about this trial, or getting afraid of, you know, some class, or not having enough work done on some class, I would begin to get a little panicky and I would begin to watch a little more, just relax. And the reason why I got hooked is because I started feeling better as soon as I just kind of let go and watched a little TV. I'd feel better. And some of you guys know what I'm talking about. I mean, there's an edge here, because you start feeling better, but it's not sustainable, this feeling better. And so you have to keep watching and keep watching and keep watching. And the pressure of what I'm not doing is building and building and building. But at some point, it's built up to a panic-stricken place here, so now I have to bear down and get this assignment done, or get ready for this exam at law school, or I'm gonna have to face the music on this trial. And inevitably, somehow, we'd pull it all off. Everything would go good, no problems. I'm all happy. You know, it's sort of like, it's good. Why would I want to look at the desire? Everything worked out okay. Why would I even want to think about it? It wasn't until I started getting into deeper, probably around about the time I started coming to Sims, and I started going to non-residentials, and I started getting more and more and more embodied in this practice. You know, it's like we all want to get embodied in the practice, but it creates some difficulties in our lives, because we can't just go back into our lives and live it exactly the same way we lived before. And so when I started getting embodied into the practice, I started beginning to see what this television watching was doing. I begin to feel into the pain of what was happening. Even as I'm watching it, I'm feeling into the pain of this. And so the whole point was, I thought, oh, I gotta get rid of the desire to watch TV. If I could just get rid of the desire to watch TV, then I won't have any problems. I tried Rodney's thing of putting the sheet over the top of the TV. If you ever go to Rodney's house for an interview, he has this little sleeve over the top of the TV. I thought, oh, that would do it. Just put a little, you know, pillowcase over the TV. I can't see it. No problem. You know that didn't work. Just move the pillowcase whenever you want to watch TV. Put it back when you want to. I needed something a little bit more powerful than that. So I tried getting rid of the TV. You know, I don't have no TV. I'm not gonna have any desire. I've cleared up the problem. But you know, we have computers. Netflix, Hulu, who knew? This didn't work. Because the mind is going to lean into that escape regardless. Because I'm not really practicing with it. Now I feel the tanha, I feel the pull of it. But I just keep wanting to get rid of that pull so I don't have the desire, and then it's all good. That leaning in, I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm trying to stop it. And you can hear the judgment in it. Like, it's just something's wrong with that. That's what we do. We do all this creative endeavor to try to stop the desiring. And the desiring is inherent as being human. It wasn't until I finally started feeling the pull away from some case. I would bring some difficult case home with me, and I would sit the case in front of me, and I would watch myself pull, I mean, everything. How casual it would be just to want to go and watch TV or watch something else and not look at that case. Eventually, I actually stopped being so caught in the desire, the tanha. I shouldn't say the desire, the tanha of television. I still watch TV, still get caught in it. But what I don't do anymore is use the television to escape some difficulty that's coming my way. It's the using of the television to escape some unpleasantness. That's the problem with it. That's how we get caught in the actual desire of it. But the only way to get there is to feel it. So there's some things that we're going to talk about the second one, and the second two desires, but some things I noticed when I started actually feeling the difficulty. The first one was that when I would think about watching TV, I would always think that I'm going to feel better and then I can do my work. Right now I'm just a little nervous, a little upset. I'm just going to feel better, then I'm going to do my work. It never happened that way. Because desire is always about something that is a way that you don't currently have, and the present moment is not okay. So it's always kind of like a used car salesman. It's always selling some idea that it's going to be better then. If we do that, if we get this, if we eat this, if we feel this, it's going to be better. The ignorance comes when we start believing that it's going to be better. We don't even know if it's going to be better, but we believe it's going to be better. And we get caught. It's like the craving of the mind's picture. The mind has created a picture of the way the world will be once I start watching TV, and I believe that that's what's going to happen. So I get caught in that. But it never lasts. That's the second thing I begin to notice, is that no matter how much television I watched, whenever I was finished watching TV, it didn't matter. My trial folder was still sitting right there. And I still was nervous about what I was going to do with it. And the last thing was, I begin to notice that whenever the show that I was watching was ending, almost even before it ended, when the show began to turn towards some kind of resolution, I begin to feel I need to find another show. I begin to sense into this needing to find something else. So it's this ever-growing, constantly having to seek after and go after. Joseph said that when Buddha saw how inherently gratifying the world was. What he said was that Buddha also saw the drawbacks of that gratification, and he saw that that gratification never lives up to the level of happiness it suggests that it's going to have. It tells us, we have this sense when we're in desire that somehow or another it's going to be great, but it never lives up to it. And then it can never really satisfy us, because inherent in that desire is this unsatisfactoriness about it. It's always going to be just shy of satisfaction, because there's no way any TV can help me get prepared for a trial, right? So it can't help me feel better. What's going to help me feel better is that I just begin to prepare for the trial. And then lastly, that inherent within that desire are limitations. And when we don't look at those limitations, we don't see the inherent limitations. And so we get trapped thinking it's going to be much better than it ends up being. So before I go too deep in it, let me just go to the second two before I actually run out of time. The second two are becoming and non-becoming. And they're kind of like, they're different than sensual pleasures, but it's the same kind of impulse. The impulse of wanting to be something, become something. The wanting to have something that is we presently don't have. So it says that it's the longing or the thirst to become or to get something, whatever it is, than what you actually have. And the difficulty of this desire lies in the striving of it. What Ajahn Sumedho says, it's the movement of that striving. Somehow it's the leaning into the striving that gives us the difficulty. So to me, we can get trapped in confusion about whether or not we are too ambitious, or maybe we shouldn't set goals, or maybe we really shouldn't even try to get anything because, you know, we'll be striving and it's a problem. And we can get trapped sometimes when we start practicing in fearing to want too much in our lives. Like even the wanting of wealth, there's almost like a sin almost to want to be wealthy or want to have money. And in some of these communities, it feels like the wanting of it is a problem, or the wanting of being successful is a problem, like it's against what it is that we're practicing towards. But that, again, is the distortion of the mind, because desire, the wanting of wealth or the wanting to be professional or the wanting or desire to be successful in whatever we do, accomplish things, that is inherently part of being human. It's almost like if you have a mind that's creative, a mind that can conceive, then the idea that it would not desire the very things that it conceives or creates doesn't make any sense, right? It's like I can conceive of being a lawyer. I want to be a lawyer. So wouldn't I just walk down the path to be a lawyer? The difficulty, if I use myself as an example, is that I put so much expectation on this being of a lawyer that when I failed the bar, everything in my world began to come crashing down. I wasn't prepared. It's like I was caught in the actual craving of wanting this, the striving such that I couldn't give myself any space If I had known back when I failed the bar and I was falling apart, that it's all good, it's gonna work out, you're gonna be a lawyer, prosecutor, 25 years, don't worry about it, I wouldn't have been freaking out. But that's 20/20 hindsight, right? I think the learning to work with desire is what that gives us, is the 20/20 hindsight, that it's all gonna work out fine. You don't have to be caught so much in the end result and how is it gonna look and whether or not this is gonna happen and the control we try to put on our lives in order for things to become a certain way, instead of just letting this natural flow of our desire to want to become something and do the steps that it takes to do. I just didn't know when I failed the bar that I would pass the bar the next time I took it. That's the only thing I didn't know. And yet, because I had gotten so glued to the striving of what I wanted to become, this failure of the bar was not included in that possibility. And because of that, everything began to fall apart. So we're not trying to not desire, not have these desires of who and what we're going to become. It's the beginning to strive towards making that so. I am going to make that so. And then we don't have any tolerance for anything that could go wrong. It's the flip side with the getting rid of and not wanting whatever emotions, anger, I don't want to be angry, I don't want to be irritated, I don't want to be sad, I don't want to be worried, I don't want to be anxious. And this idea that if I somehow or another don't want to be anxious and so I get rid of that anxiousness, that's what's going to make me happy. We get convinced of that. And the only reason why we're convinced of it is because we have anxiousness and we want to get rid of it. And as soon as I get rid of it, then I know I'm going to be happy, because I'm not happy now. But when you try to get rid of the anxiousness, it doesn't go anywhere. And the anxiousness itself just keeps coming back, coming back, coming back. But if we learn to be with both the desire to not want to be anxious and the reality that anxiousness is here in this much more neutral place, then gradually over time, this anxiousness begins to subside. So I want to make sure I say this last thing before I move on, or before we end. So someone asked me, I think it was the first week, how all of this connects to this nobility. I said that, you know, that this nobility is the quality of being, qualities that people admire. You know, this kind of high, I don't want to say high class, because the word class has such negative connotations, but it's this nobility, this dignity that comes from doing this work. And this is what I've come to understand, having spent so much time with the pain of the tanha around desire, is that most of the desires I dealt with, most of the desires I look at, most of the desires we have that we deal with all the time, that all this second noble truth suffering is coming around, is the superficial level of living, being a human being. It's the basic day-to-day kind of wanting and not wanting, and I'm not comfortable, and that's not agreeable, and I want this and I want that. It's just our superficial everyday existence. It's like the distraction from the lower, deeper qualities of aspirations we have for goodwill and kindness and peace all over the world, for everyone to have this sense of kindness and goodwill and peace. It's inherent in our practice. There's always this deeper thread of wanting all beings to be happy, of wanting all beings to feel the sense of well-being and peace. But these superficial desires kind of get in the way, and we get so trapped and enamored by them that we go running after them. And we lose sight of this deeper, deeper place. But when we begin to settle in this tanha, when we begin to feel that tanha and let it just be, we don't necessarily follow the impulses of these desires so rapidly. We can begin to see some freedom from it. And when we can take that layer of distorted kind of running after, chasing after desires, when we take that layer off, what gets opened is this much more deeper aspiration that has lasting impacts on people. That's why I think these qualities of why these noble truths are ennobling, this verb of actually ennobling us, our willingness to look at and stay with the hunger for these much more basic, random, everyday life desires, our willingness to stay with that hunger and watch it, is what in the long run helps us connect to this deeper, you know, that quiet, deep longing for the world to be at peace and at rest. Gil Franston said that the sensitivity and awareness that arises from working with the cravings around these three desires brings us basically two benefits. We can open ourselves up to these deeper aspirations, and we can learn to see the origination, the cause of suffering at its beginning, and not get lost in it. So I want to end with this reading from Ajahn Sumedho. I just cannot say, I just don't think I have the wherewithal to begin to explain some of these concepts the way some of these great masters can explain it. And I tried all day to figure out a way to write this in here, and I was like, you know what, that's it. I'm not even going to try. I'm just going to read it. He says, usually we equate suffering with feeling, but feeling is not suffering. It is the grasping of desire that is suffering. Desire does not cause suffering. The cause of suffering is the grasping of desire. This statement is for your reflection and contemplations in terms of your own individual experience. You really have to investigate desire and know it for what it is. You have to know what is natural and necessary for survival and what is not necessary for survival. We can be very idealistic in thinking, and even the need for food is some kind of desire we should not have. One can be quite ridiculous about it. But the Buddha was not an idealist, and he was not a moralist. He was not trying to condemn anything. He was trying to awaken us to truth so that we could see things clearly. Once there is clarity and seeing in the right way, then there is no suffering. When you really see the origin of suffering, you realize that the problem is the grasping of desire, not the desire itself. Grasping means being deluded by, thinking it's really me or mine. These desires are me, or there is something wrong with me for having them. Or I don't like the way I am now. I have to become something else, or I have to get rid of something before I can become what I want to be. All this is desire. So you listen to it with bare attention, not saying that it's good or bad, but merely recognizing it for what it is. If we contemplate desires and listen to them, we actually are no longer attached to them. We are just allowing them to be the way they are. Then we can come to the realization that the origin of suffering, desire, can be laid aside and let go of. And how do you let go of things? This means you leave them as they are. So let's just let Tomato's words be the end of it. We'll just sit a moment. Okay, thank you for your kind attention, and I'll see if there's any questions. I'm gonna feel kind of bad if I'm the only one in here with desire. I'm telling you that right now. I'm the only one that's to investigate desire. Yes.
So where the becoming and not becoming, can you maybe just clarify if that, because I've understood that to be really a, you know, kind of a identification with a self.
Yes.
I mean, really, both of them probably. One that a self that you want to become, or a self that you want to get rid of.
And mm-hmm. So the question is, to explain, he had heard that the becoming and not becoming is more related to selfing, and whether or not it's like you want to become a certain self or not become a certain self. And yes, that's, I didn't say it that way, but that's what I think, that's the same way I've learned it. But the selfing is not just I want to become something, but there's also the selfing in seeing myself as being an angry person, or seeing myself as, or seeing something, my nice car is somehow connected to me, that makes me a special person because I have this car. So it's all that, it's all the ways in which our living out our lives is also creating this selfing image with us. This is mine, that is mine, or I don't want to be angry because I don't want to see myself as an angry person. So the wanting to get rid of some quality about myself. But all of that is selfing. All of that is the inherent in the seeing something as me or I or mine. So yeah. Yeah.
Can't by willpower I never really will win by willpower saying I don't really want that, I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to let go of that. But when I see that I'm thinking that if I had that, that I would be, you know, have this happiness or whatever, it's a disenchantment. I have to see that. As soon as I get the disenchantment, then I can let, you know, I can...
Yes.
It's much easier to not get caught in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the comment was that getting stuck in the if only I had, or if only this, or if only that, and believing that somehow or another that if only is where the happiness is going to lie. And so it's seeing into the disenchantment of that. I think it's really seeing into the disenchantment of that. But we never really see into the disenchantment if we're not willing to challenge and be with some of these desires in order to feel into it and see that it doesn't actually work. And that, I think that's why we have to sort of stay in the middle, this kind of middle place of both wanting it to be that way, wanting it to be a certain way, and the reality that it's not. And somehow in the staying in the middle of that is where I think the disenchantment comes. We can begin to see and feel that it doesn't work. And even with my television watching, it wasn't like the only way I begin to free myself from the grasping of that didn't only come from not watching TV. It actually came from sitting there watching TV mindfully, feeling the pressure of knowing that I need to work on my trial. It's sort of like the need to work on the trial never actually left. That feeling, whatever that pressure was about doing that trial, was always there. But the distraction of watching TV was supposed to help me not feel that. But when I started being mindful about watching TV, you see what came up was also the awareness of the pressure of not doing my work. I brought it home, and then I'm not doing it, not doing it, not doing it. It also made it both difficult to watch TV and easy to not watch TV at the same time. So eventually, my ability to just turn the TV off became... I just had this, like, insight here. Give me a moment. Like, I'm realizing that actually... the desire to move towards the taking on this trial, getting prepared, became stronger than the desire to watch TV. That's actually what happened. It was that I had them both going, and it kind of flipped. Excuse me. So it started out the desire... Thank you. The desire to watch TV was bigger than the pressure. And then the unpleasantness of watching TV got stronger and stronger and stronger. And then the desire to work on my case became the bigger desire. If only I would work on my case, I'd feel better. I can't believe it. It's just amazing that when we work with these, it's sort of like the reason why I think this practice is so encouraging and so supportive is not the misery of what we have to face. It is the reality that if we turn and face what the mind thinks is misery, we find that it is not. But if we don't turn and look at it, we never know that. The mind will have us convinced that turning towards that difficulty, it's all going to be horrible. I remember one time at a retreat, Rodney. I had a really difficult retreat with Rodney, and we were all together in the evening talk. It was a week-long retreat, so by the very last full night, the last night of the retreat, the room is very still, and it's, you know, there's not a peep in there. Nobody's even moving. And Rodney gave some Dhamma talk, and in the middle of his Dhamma talk, he said that, you know, sometimes suffering is like this lion that's coming at you, and it's, you can see it in the distance, and it's plopping forward, and it's coming, it's charging, and you're standing there. But if you stand there and it gets all the way up to you, you realize it doesn't have any teeth. It could gum you, you know, but it can't really do anything. And you know, Rodney was notorious for analogies, and I lost it. I busted out and started laughing, and I could not. I kept trying to control myself because, you know, I felt like I didn't want to interrupt his talk, but it was the first visualization that I had that all these major fears that I thought were out there, these big, horrific things that I was so afraid of when I first began to come into the practice and get embodied, and I had all these trauma things that I was afraid of, that I began to realize it was all thought. It was all in the sense of desiring to get rid of, the desire to not have that, the desire to be something else. And the craving for that was far bigger than the actual thing that I was going to look at and face. And when he said that, I totally understood it. I was just lost in it. And then when I finally quieted down and I finally got myself to stop laughing, get back into the way things are supposed to be, he just said, "It's so nice to hear you laugh about that, Tawari." Because he knew that I understood that the big looming thing that we think that the desire is supposed to help us not have to deal with is not really that big at all. It's like a little, you know, it's like Tigger. You know, it's like, what's Tigger gonna do? He said, bounce around or something. It's seeing that. And I think that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi was saying. If conceptually you understand that, that's one thing. But if perceptionally you see it by turning towards the tanha to try to avoid something, if you turn towards that and see it, then something shifts. Something shifts in our understanding, and that shift is what frees us. And I think by the time we get to the fourth truth, we'll build up a little bit of courage to turn towards it. That's the path that actually helps us turn towards it. Well, I hope you guys are all sitting there like, yeah, I'm going to really work on my desires. I hope you're all motivated, inspired. Yeah.
For me, it's not on television watching, it's reading.
Reading. But that seems so wholesome. Goodness. Okay. Not going to judge it. Oh, yes, my sister.
You know, I can see that you're friends. But what interests me is the way the
Yes. On the reading.
On reading.
Yes.
Yes. So
the comment is that her edge, her desire is in reading rather than watching TV, but that if she notices that she's avoiding doing something by the reading, then she focuses her attention more directly on the reading. And that is it right there, because we whatever it is that you're avoiding seems like that's the problem, but the reading is going to help me feel better so that I can even take on that, but I just need to take some time to feel better. But it never satisfies. It just keeps, you just have to keep reading, and the problem just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I think from everything I've read and my own practices, I think the pointing is to not stop reading, but don't let the mind ignore that glooming thing over there. It's like, can you hold them both, right? The idea that you're avoiding and the enjoyment of the reading. And I think when you begin to hold them both in this neutral place, is what Tsumedo is saying, you're not attached to the desire anymore, the craving anymore. You're not attached to that grasping. And because you're not attached to the grasping, you can actually begin to investigate the nature of this difficulty with the reading to avoid. And if it's a long-standing habit, like with reading from when you were a little kid, this is not something that's going to go quietly into the good night. You know, it's sort of like you'll be working with it. But the gift of what this is that reading is something that's so acutely aware to you of a desire that you can practice with it continuously. And what the mind learns in your practicing around reading and desire, it applies to many desires. That is the nature of wisdom. It isn't that just because I get this wisdom right here, then I gotta go try it over here, then I gotta go try it over here. Intellectually, that's the way we have to do life. We have to learn this intellectually. But in this more perceptual wisdom, when the mind learns and begins to understand desire, it will see that learning in every desire that shows up. So it's sort of like this gift that you have of reading and seeing that is actually the opportunity for you to practice with something that's readily available with you right there. And it just means holding, reading, and the thing you're not doing simultaneously. But be forewarned, you will not look at reading the same way. I mean, we do end up, it doesn't mean that you're gonna never read again, but the obsessive reading, you begin to see it as an obsession and begin to pull away from it. It's the disenchantment that Lauren was talking about. Kind of takes the glimmer out of it, I guess. That's right. Takes the obsession out of it and just lets it be something enjoyable, something that you do. You know, just a human desire. That's fine. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of doing them, and she keeps sabotaging. How do I kindly tell her, because I really like this lecture, to explain to her about this?
Sorry, So the question is, so I have this, the comment is that there's a friend that is basically obsessing over doing these other things to avoid dealing with something difficult that they have to deal with. And so the question then becomes, how do I help my friend
recognize
that? Short answer, you can't. Might as well let it go. It's the whole pointing of the practice is that wisdom is something that you experience and learn. So maybe you could say that if you begin to watch your own desires, if you begin to watch the place where you are avoiding by seeking pleasure and doing the same things, if you begin to watch that, you will begin to get this wisdom that's connected to the learning attached to that. And when you get that wisdom, then your ability to just speak from that wisdom comes. And your ability to talk to her from a place of your own experience would probably be more helpful. But if you tried to tell her, you should do this because I'm seeing something you're doing, that's not going to work out. Not so well. It's probably better to just do the own practice yourself and see, and then talk from what you've learned when you see. Good. All right. Oh, one more. We'll take one more and then we'll.
How about this is to do with, I think, something, but suppose you're unhappy with the way you
are.
The way you look, the way you act, the way you've been all your life, or whatever.
That's right.
Unhappy with yourself, but yourself again.
Yeah. So I think I spent the bulk of my life hating me, wishing I was somebody else. And I just think that the more you get quiet and feel into the nature of what's happening in a given moment, that natural ability to begin to care about yourself actually starts rising. It doesn't come from, I spent the bulk of my life trying to do all these self-help things that would make me better, and it didn't make me better. So it's really more when I started meditating and getting quiet with me, even the anxiety, the worry, the panic, all the anger, all that stuff. When I started being quiet with me, that sense of quietness is what underneath it also triggered this sense of caring and kindness and all the other qualities that I always thought everybody else had and not me. So a lot of this is being in this non-judging, accepting way of letting whatever is present just be present and be still with it. And it doesn't seem like it works us through, but it's the waiting and the being still and allowing the mind to see, it's just allowing that wisdom to come up and see things as they really are. Because mostly, everything we think is bad about ourselves, none of it's true. But we don't know that unless we get still and begin to feel into the nature of that kinder side of ourselves. All right, well, thank you kindly.